Before we start talking about neurotics, may I tell you that this morning I was crossing Fifth Avenue at about 38th Street, and there was a mother with a little girl, about 4 years of age, out in the middle of the street. It was a New York cop, John Flanagan, directing traffic. And the little girl said to his mother, "Mummy, was that policeman ever a baby?" And the mother said, "Yes." She said, "You know, I've never seen a baby policeman." Apropos of neurotics, there was a mother who brought her child to a psychiatrist. And she said, "I don't know why he is insecure. Everyone else in the neighborhood is." Which brings up the question, are we more neurotic on these days? Now, there are two answers. We're going to consider both. One answer is, well, we are not more neurotic. There have always been both psychotics and neurotics. Take, for example, very famous people have done queer things. The poet Percy Bysshe Shelley, for example, had a passion for building paper boats. He would float them in the bathtub. And one day he didn't have any paper, and he made a boat out of a 50-pound bill. Spinoza, the philosopher, you know what he was fond of doing? He was fond of catching spiders and matching them one against another and watching them fight. Batavius used to get up from his chair at the end of every second hour of work and spin it around 10 times, then sit down and work for another 2 hours. But those who hold that we are not more neurotic today than before use such arguments as these. First of all, in 1853, there was a work, just think, 1853, a work published, The Great Disease of Our Times, Neuroses, work by Weinecke. The University of Tübingen in Germany made a study of neuroses and came to the conclusion that we are not more neurotic. It is only the symptoms that have changed. Now, suppose we take this position and analyze it. Have the symptoms of neuroses changed? But as far as quantity is concerned, there are no more neuroses. It is possible. What was the great difference between the old neuroses, previous days, and our very modern ones? The difference was this, that in the... You know, in all the years I've been on television, for example, I've never found a neurotic angel. They're always normal. And my present angel, named after an Old Testament character, Eli, is just about as normal as blueberry pie. But here's the difference between the old neuroses and the new, indicating a change of symptoms. The old neuroses were of the moral order. That is to say, people became neurotic because they became disordered in their relationship either to God, to their neighbor, or to themselves. That, for example, was the problem with the prodigal son. See, he broke this threefold bond. He left the father's house. He became alienated from neighbor because he cleaved to a citizen of the foreign country. He became a feeder of swine. And then finally, he was alienated from himself because when he finally did return, it was because he entered into himself. So in these days, Men became neurotic because of a sense of guilt. They broke a bond with love. And that's the right understanding of guilt, normal guilt. Hurting someone that you love. That's the meaning of a crucifix. There's the picture of someone I love. Now, these were the old symptoms. What are the new symptoms? The new symptoms are either fiscal or physical. That is to say, people today become neurotic, not because they break a relationship with divine love and with neighbor and with themselves. They become neurotic either on account of money or on account of health. Think of how many people today have neuroses simply because they've lost money, they're afraid of losing it, or they're not able to keep up with the Joneses. The history of America could be written in terms of money, our recessions, our depressions, and our panics. Recession is where you tighten your belt. A depression is where you have no belt. And a panic is where you have no pants. So modern neuroses are born of money. And also fear of losing health. You see, the great dread that anyone has that produces a neurosis all depends upon what they fear losing. Here it was relationship with love. Here one of these two. Just think of the commercials, for example. Think of how neurotic we're becoming when, for example, here is a boy who, a young man whose hair is a bit unruly. He can't find a girl. And suddenly, out of nowhere, comes a faceless man who hands him a tube. He gets his oil changed. He puts it on his hair. Glory be to God, there are about 20 girls around all of a sudden. You know, you just think of a man going crazy because he lacks oil in his hair. And then bad breath. Oh. The neuroses that are induced. There are meetings in offices. Will we tell Mary? Shall we tell John? I don't think I've got the courage to tell him. And then they meet even football players. Great big men you'd think you shouldn't worry about bad breath. Here they are all meeting. I wonder if we should tell our coach. These big cowards weighing 300 pounds. I'm afraid to tell him he's got bad breath. And the man with bad breath comes in. He's got a bottle of hope in his hand. He's healthy. He's not neurotic. And then hands. Oh. Poor wife who's lost the love of the husband. He touched her hand last night. It was scaly. She calls in the neighbors. She's losing her husband's love. Scaly hands. Suddenly, out of nowhere, there comes a bottle. What does she do now to cure herself? What's the cure of this neurosis? Wash dishes. Puts a few drops of this magic fluid in the dishes, and lo and behold, her husband and the wife are reunited. Why do we have to have divorces in the United States when all we could do is get new soap? Well, that's the difference between the old and new neuroses. And so this is the answer to one question. Namely, are we more neurotic? Many say, no, we are not, only the symptoms have changed. Now, that could very well be. But let's take the other position. Then you can decide for yourselves when we've given both arguments. The other argument is that we are much more neurotic on account of an entirely different philosophy of life. Now, this philosophy of life is not often expressed. It's just hidden in what you read and what many young people do. But I'm going to write out the two propositions of this philosophy of life. The first proposition is, every experience is valid. That's the first proposition. Namely, anything that gives pleasure is right. You're never concerned about what anyone outside of that experience thinks. Society, moral order, parents. No. Experience of pleasure is judged of and by itself. Hence, get all the kicks you can out of life. It's the kick that matters. Nothing else. Breaking school windows, all right, you get a kick out of it. Well, are there any differences between experiences of pleasure? Yes, there are, and that brings us to the second principle. And the second principle is, the more intense the pleasure or the experience, the more it is valid. For example, drugs, speeding. One is not going anywhere, but the faster you drive, the greater is your pleasure. And hence one looks for a new and deeper kind of experience, whatever it may happen to be. Now, are these principles valid? They're not. They're producing a tremendous amount of neurotics. Did you know, for example, that 25% of the clinical cases in psychiatric hospitals in the United States are cases of adolescents. Adolescents who have started with this philosophy. Now, let us judge it. What does it mean when we say that every experience is valid of and by itself? It means that there is not to be an object to judge the experience. Now, normally we have, in making any judgment, we have what? We have a subject, we have an object, and we have the relationship between the two, which is the judgment. For example, suppose I say that this blackboard here is 3.5 feet tall. I, the subject, make a judgment, and I have an experience of height, but how do I judge it? I judge it by an object. All of our experiences, as rational beings, are to be determined by objects. For example, I have a clock up there on top of the camera. The clock says I have 10 minutes yet to talk. Well, I can't simply say, well, I've got 15 minutes to talk and pay no attention to the clock. My experience of talking to you is judged by that object. Space is measured by it. This is one of the reasons this dropping of the object is, incidentally, the essence of decadence. Any civilization begins to decay when the subject alone is all important. The great I. Well, I decide it's right. I decide it's good. Therefore, it is. Modern painting is often without an object. You can't tell whether it's a drunken man going upstairs or stairs going up a drunken man. Now, for example, just 3 weeks ago in the White House, they discovered a painting hanging upside down. Imagine in the White House. How did they know it was upside down? By the signature. But listen, that needn't be the telltale, because maybe the artist objectively said, listen, I feel better painting this on my head. Look at the twisted ironworks that we have on Park Avenue. Some of our entrances to buildings. They tell absolutely nothing. This is a world of subjects. You can get out of it anything that you please. So, our civilization decays when we drop standards, goals, objects, purposes, and destinies. And that's what we Americans have to watch. And is it always the intensity of the experience that makes it all the more valid? When, for example, this mother in one of our western states cut up her baby with broken bottles? Was she justified in it? It was an intense experience. Was Madame Koch of Germany, who made lampshades out of the skin of the Jews that were thrown into furnaces? Was that right or was it wrong? And if you say that you may judge without an object or without a standard, how will you ever condemn Hitler? Boy mugs an old woman 84 years old. You got a kick out of it. Is that the standard? Is that the judgment? Suppose a waitress brings in a couple of eggs to these people who hold it. Experience alone is valid. One of the eggs is good, the other is bad. Why does he say that egg is bad? If he says the egg is bad, he's judging by the standard, outside of himself, by the object. Why did he order eggs in the first place? And the waitress might say to him, if he was judging everything subjectively, well, if it tastes bad to you, hand it over to him because he's got a good taste. I remember once I went into a restaurant and I asked for some toast, a cup of coffee, an egg, and a few kind words. And the waiter brought me back toast, coffee, the egg, and the check. I said, haven't you got a few kind words? She said, don't eat the egg. So, there are those, therefore, that would also hold that neuroses are increasing, and I believe that. And I believe it on account of this false philosophy which is taking over our nation. That every experience of every individual is right, without any relation to a goal or a purpose. If you want a real good philosophy along these lines, read Viktor, V-I-K-T-O-R, Viktor Frankl. Frankl, a Jewish psychiatrist of the University of Vienna. Was given us psychology called logotherapy, L-O-G-O, T-H-E-R-A-P-Y. Anything of his is worth reading. Man who went through concentration camps, suffered under the Nazis, suffered under the communists. And he came out of it all saying that he survived simply because he realized that life had a meaning. He told me not very long ago, and I had dinner with him. That when the Nazis began their persecution, he had an opportunity to come to the United States to start his new school of psychology and psychiatry, logotherapy. He wanted to do it. He had the passport. His father was living. And he was sure that the Nazis would begin an intense persecution. Dr. Frankl said he went to the Church of St. Stephen's in Vienna, knelt down for an hour, he prayed for wisdom. What should he do? Should he go to America? Or should he stay with his father? Watch his father maybe undergo the Nazi persecution and watch himself go through it as well. He came back to the house without a clear answer, but as he sat down to table with his father, he said to his father, "What is that over there on that other table?" Father said, "A piece of marble. I picked it up today at the synagogue. Remember? Remember the synagogue that Hitler burned? Our synagogue? Well, I went over there and I rummaged among the dust and the ashes and the burnt embers and I found this broken piece of marble." Viktor Frankl said to his father, "Did you ever try to figure out what it was?" "No," he said, "I haven't." Well, he said, "Let's look at it." It was in Hebrew. First three letters of one of the commandments. The fourth. "Thou shalt honor thy father and thy mother." That was the answer Viktor Frankl wanted. And that night he had a dream. In that dream he saw tens of thousands of his fellow Jews going into laboratories and into furnaces to be burned. And he willed to stay. And he came out normal. And he said everybody else that was in prison with him, that had an object, that had a goal and a purpose in life, was normal too. Life is not just made up by experiences that are intense, but experiences that are intense in relationship to an object. This is gold. This is happiness. This is joy.